90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
Brian Levinka.
Matthew Williams.
Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And tonight on Queer Voices, we will be looking back at 50 years of gay pride. We will also have news wrap from This Way Out. And Jack, it's going to be, you're going to be talking about some of your history.
Yes. But today is the 3rd of June.
Yes.
Just another sleepy, dusty Delta day.
What's okay. that from?
And Billy Joe McAllister was thrown off the Tallahassee Bridge.
Ah, yeah.
An incredible song that goes back, and the story is just a real interesting story. Did very well. I loved that time of, you know, when music was on there. Choctaw Ridge. Interesting story. But yeah, we're going to be talking about going back 50 years and what some of the trials and tribulations that our guests had, including me. Of putting things together, getting things together, talking about it, and the institutions that we all helped build.
You don't have to be gay to sing along on this song. But it helps. The British police are the best in the world. I don't believe one of these stories I've heard about them raiding gay pubs for no reason at all. Lining the customers up by the wall. Picking out people, knocking them down, resisting arrest as they're kicked on the ground, searching their houses, calling them queer. Technically, but that sort of thing happens here. Sing if you're glad to be gay, sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing glad to be gay, sing if you're happy that way. Pictures of naked young women are fun in Penthouse and Playboy, page 3 of the Sun. There's no nudes in Gay News or Lost magazine, but they still found excuses to call it obscene. Read how disgusting we are in the press, The Telegraph, People and Sunday Express. Molesters of children, corruptors of youth. It's there in the paper, it must be the truth. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way.
This is Queer Voices.
That was a longer version of Tom Robinson's Glad to Be Gay, recorded around 1979, because the album was entitled Cabaret 1979. He recently did a updated version outside of 10 Downing Street in Britain because of Theresa May's lack of dealing with GLBT issues, being with the Conservative Party.
He's done at least 20 versions of
that song. Yes, over the years. So 50 years ago this month, it would have been unimaginable that I can be sitting behind this microphone talking to you over a 100,000-watt transmitter in the fourth largest city in the country. 50 years ago, when those so-called marginal people basically said, enough is enough is enough, and they weren't marginal people to me, but they were to a lot of people in society. They basically said enough, and they did the barricades. They just pushed back and said, you know, we don't have any space of our own. We can't even have a mafia run, a health hazard, no running water, watered down drinks that were much more expensive. They were busted for even having that space. And as great as that was, that finally they did that, the fact that a year later, people commemorated that in about four or five different cities across the U.S. And through that grew pride celebrations around the world, from Sydney, Australia, to places where it's not even legal to do it, and people basically faced getting executed for trying to do pride celebrations. Originally, they were marches and protests, and they got to be more, even more commercial, but it's sort of a interesting thing that some of the major corporations are supporting some of these pride events in some of these cities. But, you know, cities like Houston and even the Woodlands are putting together pride celebrations in some way commemorating what was done. And through that, other organizations were born. You know, Pacifica was around before Stonewall, but Pacifica has had GLBT programming on almost every one of its stations at some form or another. Here in Houston, we've been doing this type of programming since 1975. That's 5 years after KPFT went on the air. And then you go beyond that. Those organizations from the Pride celebrations that formed were organizations like the Montrose Clinic, which is the Montrose Center, Legacy, which was the Montrose that was the clinic. The Montrose Center was a Montrose Counseling Center. And then that spawned other political organizations. And I think a lot of us never would have imagined that we got as far as we did. At the same time, we still got to move further because the attacks are still there. We still have people being murdered as part of our community, and we still got to do that. So this month, we're going to be doing a series of interviews talking about some of the people that have been around a while. That includes me. So
you're saying we're old?
Yes, we're old. We're
seasoned.
You know, we're old. We've been around it. We saw a lot of these things. And actually, in one of the programs, we're going to have younger people to talk about how they learn from the past or how they're dealing with it. So tonight, J.D. Doyle, who's was part of this program years past and still contributes, and has done some wonderful historical websites of the community and Texas and the music that our community has done great. And Alexis Melvin, who has recently been, I guess we call ourselves friends or allies or as enemies sometimes.
Which friendly as people get with you, Jeff.
Yeah, but has been around and is with a number of transgendered organizations and helps them move forward on it. So I just want to open this up and let's look back at, you know, where we came from personally, how we got involved in this community, and what all of this work. You know, sometimes it's great work, it's great rewarding, but sometimes it's been really tough.
I'd like to interject some prehistory. Before Stonewall, people just weren't sitting on sofas. There were lots of activities, lots of protests in Los Angeles, in Philadelphia, in other areas. And I've heard it described that Stonewall was not the starting point, it was the turning point.
That's a very good analysis.
And I think that's a good point, because we were doing a lot of stuff in New York that I was going out to work with Lee Brewster on, and then some in Boston before Stonewall. I mean, we'd done something about 2 weeks before Stonewall that I was in New York for, and Lee was trying to find a reason to sue to get the laws thrown out. It took till early 70s before that happened.
Who was Lee Brewster?
Lee Brewster.
Who was he?
Lee's sort of interesting. Lee grew up in a log cabin in one of the seaboard states, joined the FBI, was thrown out of the FBI because he was a homosexual. Went to New York, started doing drag, started Lee's Mardi Gras boutique, as well as, and that was first of all mail order, but then people kept showing up at his apartment. And then he opened Lee's Mardi Gras Boutique, which is actually two blocks size store, second floor in New York. And it's sort of like the place. And it was for transgender people, drag queens, alternative sex. And it had the
performers and so forth.
Yeah, the whole bit. It had the greatest set of the pseudo-pornographic books that you've ever seen in your life. Literally aisles and aisles and aisles and aisles and aisles, and you could spend your entire life sitting there reading or looking or buying or whatever. And Lee's whole thing was to get the laws thrown out and make everyone legitimate.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. There were things done before Stonewall. I guess Stonewall was sort of a focusing point. And it was somewhat reported around the country. I was 15 at the time, so I didn't know about it until many years later. And I was about 100 miles outside of New York City. So it probably was it was in the paper. I just didn't know about it.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been in the Chronicle.
or the Scranton Times,
I found out about Stonewall about 2 weeks afterwards when I went back to do some stuff in New York with Lee. And it was sort of like, okay, everybody needs to understand some other stuff has happened. And that's when we first heard about it.
Well, let's describe what life was like around that time or shortly after that time. People would get arrested. I mean, the bars were busted. They were mafia-run bars in most cities.
Right.
They were in poor health. You know, they were in terrible condition. The drinks were overpriced and watered down and probably not even safe. Some of the bars, including Stonewall, didn't even have running water.
And you could get arrested or hassled for any reason or no reason. I mean, that was the whole thing. You just sort of played in between. I mean, one of my things and the way I looked at it was that at that point in time, don't forget, we had Vietnam, we had anti-war protesters, and they actually came from two sides. They came from the people who didn't want the war, and they came from the people that didn't like the way we were running the war and that. And my draft number was number 21, which meant I was going as soon as I got out of school, and I was staying in chemical engineering because that was the only thing I could get a referral for. So my assumption was that I was going to Vietnam and die, so I didn't care too much if I got busted. I mean, if I got a felony, they wouldn't take me in the Army. And I'm like, is this good or bad? I don't really, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, this sounds funny, but that was the logic. So it's like, I'm just going to go do the stuff that feels right to me. And, you know, I was young and a kid. And so it's like, this is all fun. And I met Lee at this meeting in Chicago that some way or other someone told me about, and I ended up going to. And so there was all of that stuff, and there was no internet, so there's no real quick communications. You had a list of phone numbers and
the phone trees.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you did not share those with anyone because people were trying to find, you know, people in the gay community, because at that time we were all gay. There was I was not transgender. I'd never heard that term at that point in time. That was early 70s when I heard that. And so, you know, it was sort of like you had to be careful because people would get killed if you leaked information.
Sure.
The transgender community still has some of that where we're worried because it started to show up again. But you know, you didn't say hi to somebody if you saw them at work because you don't know what's going to happen. And somebody might say, how do you know that person? And now it gets all a big problem. And then if they wanted to say hi, you'd sort of nod and you could talk. But it was very interesting because it just wasn't okay. At that particular time in New York, if you were in the theater and you were found to be a homosexual person, you were out of a job and couldn't work. Same thing on Wall Street. Now, after Stonewall, it was like apparently everyone in the theater and everyone on Wall Street is actually gay. I mean, seriously, it changed so quickly.
J.D., what are some of your early memories of
being? I came out in 1978, so I missed
that
10 years. But I was... Before that, I worked for Kodak in Rochester for 8 years. I got tired of the frozen north, moved to Norfolk, Virginia, and was not thinking of coming out, but a week later, I was out. And I joined a gay group, the Unitarian Universalist Gay Community, which did everything for the community. And they had the switchboard, they had spaghetti dinners, they did the protests that were needed, and the newspaper. And within a year of joining that group, I was editor of the newspaper. So I was on a crash course. So I have all those memories of networking with the people we heard about that we wrote about, the people from NGTF, Harry Hay that we brought down for conferences, and musicians. And so all these people I was learning about, and I was reading every book I could read. It was crash course.
Well, and you mentioned newspapers. That was one of the big things, is that you got newsletters and newspapers from groups all over the country, and that was the only way you got information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, some of them were like Gay Community News out of Boston and Toronto had a paper.
Body Politic.
Body Politic right. was great. And, I mean, their stories sometimes would be months old because there was mm-hmm. not a wire service.
Like the Advocate started 67, I think.
Yeah, and...
But it was really local L.A. at that time.
Yeah, right, right, right. And but the gay press was really something important to our community. Probably almost every major city and even some of the smaller cities had some type of newspaper. And it may have not been the greatest thing, but it was crucial.
Yes, and we struggled with those newspapers.
Sure.
You know, we didn't have programs to do the typing for us and do the layout. We typed it by hand. We did something called chart pack to do the headlines where you rubbed the decal onto the page,
right.
whatever size you want, whatever font you wanted. This was really crude.
Yeah.
In the Transgender Archives, we have a lot of the originals, the mock-ups to be printed, uh-huh. and they're really funny to look at. And people are like, what is all that stuff? And you have, you know, if you're old, you sit down and explain it because they've never seen it.
This is what we could do.
And those who remember TWIT here in Texas, having a statewide magazine was pretty incredible.
Yes,
that it
yes.
got distributed to you know to the major cities throughout the state.
I think it's a lot more respected now than
yeah.
than we respected
yeah.
it then.
Exactly, exactly. So that was really important, and we did have you know gay radio in some of the major cities. The GLPT radio, Pacific, of course, was you know every one of their stations. But there was other community stations around the country that did GLPT programming, and it definitely was a lot more important back then than it is now.
Right, Berkeley had a good one. IMRU in L.A. or was that San Francisco?
It's L.A. I think.
L.A.
Yeah, 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 and. Getting information out was, you know, because we didn't have the internet, we didn't have Facebook, it was very, very important.
And once it was broadcast, it was gone.
Yeah.
No archives that we could tap into.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So, J.D., you do a lot of archival work now, putting it on the web, and you've done a lot of research back in, you know, from the early days.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things that you've learned by doing this?
Focus. Research takes a lot of focus, and you develop a knack for pulling the information out and knowing kind of what to search for. And if you get this result, then I'll try this result, and I'll try this kind of search. And a lot of the searches I do are on my own site.
Wow, yeah. Wow. And Alexis, you work with the Transgender Archives.
Right, and we have we do a lot of the same thing. I was just listening. It's the same type stuff because, you know, we get stuff literally every day in the mail, and a lot of times we have no clue what it is. Usually we probably do or someone knows what it is, but then you start trying to figure out whether it's something really important or who knows, and you start doing the research with that. And as J.D. said, it's always funny because you'll go through and all of a sudden you'll say, I'm back on my own site. How did I get here? Or on J.D.'s a lot of times
when I Google, I get back on my own site.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, that's one of the interesting things. The thing I remember, I mean, I came out in 1955. So, you know, it was like there wasn't anything. I mean, we just got television for the first time. And the first newsletter I saw that mentioned anything about any, what we would now call, you know, LGBT type community was mimeographed.
Sure.
It was male mimeographed. It was folded. Then it was put in an envelope. Yeah. Then that envelope was put in another envelope so that people had no idea what was there. And you know, it was marked with some fictitious return address and the whole bit. Well, the problem with those is they only last about a year. Maybe two at the most. It was like that.
Well,
the blue.
And also the post office would censor some of the stuff that went through the mail. So we were they were not our, you know, they were our enemy in some way.
The first lesbian publication, Vice Versa, is the first lesbian or gay publication. It was 1947, done by a secretary who had to be at this desk all day, and she wasn't given a lot to do, so the boss said, do whatever you want. So she did this newsletter, and she did it for a year, and it was a number of pages called Vice Versa, and she would type it and mimeograph it and do about 10 copies, pass them around to her friends, and they were supposed to pass them around and so
right,
forth.
Right, right, yeah.
And so that's how it started.
Absolutely, yeah.
Some of the stuff got real interesting. Like in the 70s, sort of late 70s, there was a group of transgender people in San Francisco that started ETVC, Educational TV Channel. They went through the mail with no problem whatsoever.
Interesting. We're talking to Alexis Melvin and J.D. Doyle about somewhat the good old days, somewhat the bad old days. One of the things that I certainly remember in the earlier time is we seemed to be a lot more knit, tight community, you know, because there were only so many of us that were out and or activist, and we had a much broader sense of what was going on in the community. And there was less organization, so you pretty much knew everybody from these different organizations.
From different cities, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I came out, it was the gay community. No alphabet after it, just the
exactly.
gay community. And many of the newspapers were the gay paper, the gay blade, or the Seattle Gay News. You know, it was all one community there.
Yeah, and it had all of the GLBT,
yeah,
I mean, the whole
bit. But it was understood.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, I always laugh. I'm like, well, when I first started, I was gay. And then I became trans. But then I sort of became bi. And I'm like, I don't know what I am. It's just, you know, the way it is. And I think, as you said, the fact that we were one community made it a lot different than today. Because right now, you know, we fight with ourselves more than we fight with other people.
Well, we used to also, though, fight with the people who were in the closet. I mean, Ray Hill used to talk a lot about that there are a lot of people angry with him because he'd be on TV or he'd be talking about these issues. And some people says, well, we have our bars and that's all we really need. You know, we don't need anything else, or we have what, you know, let's keep what we
don't
have.
Don't shake the bushes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And of course, you know, the bars played an incredible ally in our community. I mean, they were businesses. But
they were sanctuaries.
Yes, and they were also meeting places and activist places. So they were very important. And in fact, we're seeing less bars now than we saw back in those days.
I think that's nationally. People are noticing that.
And I think the big thing is, it's because right now, for instance, if I want to go to a bar in Houston, other than a couple biker bars that I wouldn't go to anyway, there's no place that I'm not comfortable going.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I first moved to Houston, which wasn't, well, it was a while ago, but when I first moved to Houston, I wouldn't go with a friend, shall we say, to any place other than the gay bars down here in the Montrose area.
On the other hand, it's like, well, you can go to a restaurant now and discuss. And
exactly.
There are meeting rooms and there's Montrose Center, among some other places where, you know, you can have meetings. And you know, I just got to say that my civic club that's right here in Avondale has had their national night out at gay establishments. And I just thought, you know, and majority of them are not gay. And I thought, well, you know, that's pretty neat. I mean, we have made a lot of progress, but still, we need to go. We're going to take a little break now, and we'll continue on with the conversation. We're talking to Alexis Melvin and J.D. Doyle about our history. You're listening to Queer Voices.
But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned how to get along. And saw your back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just 1 second you'd be back to bother me, oh, now go. Walk out the door. Just you're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me with goodbye? You think I grumbled? You think I'd lay down and die? Oh, no, not I. I will survive. Oh, as long as I know how to love, I know I'll be alive. I've got all my life to live. I've got all my love to give. And I'll survive. I will survive.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, we continue our discussion, and I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about organizing, about how the community did. I mean, Houston, In the GLBT community, sometimes the middle of the country, and not only in our community, was considered the flyover country, and they didn't really think about a lot of stuff that did happen here. And of course, one of the main things that happened here was the arrest of Lawrence versus, you know, Lawrence on the 2106, the sodomy law charges, and that went up all the way to Supreme Court, and then with its overturning, that really allowed same-sex marriage equality.
I don't think the country gives us credit for that.
No. And what's really interesting is that story, which is pretty complex, about how the people behind the scenes, including Glenn Lewis, mm-hmm. Anise Parker, and who else am I missing here, helped putting that together. And
like kept chess pieces.
And kept it going so that it would move there. Oh, Ray Hill, of course. That a case, it was sort of like the Rosa Parks case. You know, you got that case and you moved it forward. You knew how to run it through.
They were arrested in 97, so it took till 2003.
Right.
Which for Supreme Court isn't too
no,
bad.
No.
But it was interesting.
But you still have to be guiding it.
Because we had, right. Lambda Legal is one of my favorite organizations.
Oh, yes.
And how they, when they took over the case or got involved in it, how they had to, you know, decide which lawyers and how to do this. And it was like really impressive of how they did it. But
well, and a lot of people seem to think when, you know, it comes up that these guys, they were sort of intended and they set this all up. They in no way wanted this.
No.
And talking with them, as I'm sure both of you probably have too, it's like, no, this was not their thing.
No, and I remember, you know, that case was decided in the Supreme Court like on a Thursday. And Pride was on a Saturday.
Yeah.
Or was it on? It was no. I think it was on a Sunday at that. Sunday, because I think it was a daytime parade still. And we were told they're very private to people. They don't want to be in the.
No, it was a nighttime parade starting in '97.
Okay. Thank you for correcting me, the historian.
Jack was running it, but, you know,
yeah.
somebody has to take
well,
the history.
Well, and those of us who run these things, it's like we, you know, sometimes
I don't know what year
we don't
it
remember the time frame and stuff yeah. like that. But they said when it was decided they wanted to be in the parade, and of course we did everything we can to make sure that they were in the parade.
I was with you when it was announced at the press conference.
Yes, and we were actually told we shouldn't have been there because that was for the national and worldwide press, and it's like
I put my mini disc recorder right on the desk.
So, but all of these things, it's like, you know, we do argue and we have different opinions, but there is strategy. You know, a lot of the stuff that Ray Hill did, sometimes people think, well, Ray just likes to shoot off his mouth. Well, he did, but there was also strategy behind that. You know, when he worked with Anise Parker and being the good cop, bad cop type things mm-hmm. and getting things done, well, there was a lot of that done, you know, sometimes accidentally and sometimes on purpose. And, you know, it's like the night parade. The night parade happened because some people says, well, maybe this is a good idea, but there was so much work done behind the scenes to make sure we can do it, et cetera, and then get the community to approve it. And the night parade isn't like the greatest civil rights thing, but it was another thing that happened in the community that made it a bigger event.
Before we leave the sodomy case, let's recommend the book by Dale Carpenter.
Absolutely.
It was called Flagrant Conduct, and it was just an extraordinary capture of that part of history.
And it's probably still archived, his interview with Diane Reams from NPR. Incredible interview. I didn't get the chance to interview him, but Brandon Wolf came and talked about the book for like 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it is incredible because it talks about so much of the history and the background of what Houston was like and how it was done. And fax machines were important back then. And gossip at the bars, you know, all this stuff led up to this thing being able to happen and brought up to the courts. And how you plead in the lower courts, and how you talk to the judge and make sure that the person was fined at a certain mm-hmm. amount so
right.
that it could advance.
Right, you don't want to take this agreement. You want to take one that would get you to somewhere else.
Yes. And how important that decision was, because that decision disallowed people from not being able to be in the police department, because there used to be a question in the Houston Police Department about, have you committed a crime? Mm-hmm. 2106 was a crime. things like that. That
there wouldn't be any gay same-sex marriage without that. Oh,
exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that, you know, that led it up, and so that was a major stepping stone for marriage equality.
And that was Houston.
That was Houston, Harris County, Houston.
And there have actually been three decisions in Houston, and I won't be able to quote them properly, which is one of the reasons that in the sort of recent last few years, we've been attacked more here by the radical right, because they're worried that if something comes through Houston, there have been two or three really major cases and one minor one that they have on their list, do not let this happen. And, you know, it's a good news, bad news. The good news is, yeah, they know that Houston is something that they have to worry about. And the bad news is they keep attacking us.
Well, Ray had his own Supreme Court case about being able to talk back to a policeman.
Yes.
That happened right outside the studio here, here at KPFT on Lovett Boulevard. And it was a very important case about civil rights and about what you can do, what you can say to a cop. And he certainly talked about it all of his life. And that's fine. But the same thing with equality here in the city of Houston is that we've lost votes by the general public time after time.
Yes, referendums.
Referendums, and that doesn't mean we stop doing it. We have to keep on fighting, and we lost vote. You know, I mean, the state legislature not only attacks our community, it attacks cities.
Right.
Because they're too damn liberal, according to them. So, you know, our cases also affect the greater community, too.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the big things, because when that happens, things get better all around and you start to see more things coming in. At the time when I was out and aware of things, San Francisco had laws against any type of homosexual conduct, which included dressing in drag. I mean, it included every little thing you could think of. New York had laws against that. Boston had laws against that. St. Louis, I think it was just a horrible offense. I live close to St. Louis, and it was sort of like people would disappear if they thought they were homosexual. Well, all those went away.
Well, Houston overturned its cross-dressing law in 1980.
Uh-huh.
Well,
and that was a zipper law. Yeah, it's where the zipper had to be.
And I remember having a conversation with Ray about, you know, possibly moving to some other city. And Ray never said you shouldn't do it. But, you know, he said, the fight continues here. And some of these other cities had a lot more laws protecting GLBT people, but we've got to change the laws everywhere, and we've got to make it acceptable everywhere. And I will certainly remember being at some of these pride conferences where some of these big cities will talk about the thing they did and the banners they put up and the city supporting them and stuff like that. And then you hear about some small town, and there was some, I think it was Topeka, Kansas, where they were able to put up the banners and the mayor just had them torn down. And more importantly, some of the places in some of the other countries where you could be executed for having that type of march or demonstration. So what we do here, what we do in the other cities, all matters.
And you know, with the other countries, it's not could, you were.
Yes.
I mean, this isn't like hypothetical.
No,
I mean,
people were being executed.
Yes. And I mean, that is still happening with the transgender community more than the gay community. I think the gay community is a little bit in better shape than the transgender community is, and we deal with that literally every day.
So do you think that the gay community is doing enough to help our brothers and sisters in the trans community?
A significant part of the gay community has thrown the trans community under the bus to get what they wanted over and over again. So the answer would be no. Now, is that universally correct? No, because a lot of times there is a lot of help. And, you know, it's just sort of the way it is.
Yeah. Well, and I've got to say, I traveled to the March on Washington. Well, we didn't travel together, but we ended up being together, me and Phyllis Fry, in the March in 87. We would commute back to Baltimore every day on the bus. And Phyllis is just a treasure. And I will remember that the day of the march, that we get to the Metro Central station in Washington, and Phyllis had this gigantic flag, or one that she can carry, and she raised it up inside that Metro station, a Texas flag, and people just started shouting, you know, and that's Phyllis. That's Phyllis. You learn, you know, that's it. We learn from each other how we can be better and be more out and be more effective. And, you know, we're the worst in criticizing each other, but sometimes that's good.
She was at the front of the 79 march, too.
Yes, yes.
Because somehow Texas got to lead the march, and Phyllis was right out there.
And you know, the weird thing is, it's Texas. Which the general reputation would say that's not the way it's going to be. But it really is. And does everybody in Texas love the GLBT community? No. But there's enough.
Well, after the 87 march in 89, there were marches in Austin during the legislative session. And then that sort of morphed into lobby days,
right?
Which is probably more effective. And, you know, we're out there. It's still tough to push forward. But I the people that go to Austin to talk about our issues, to talk to the legislators, that has to be done.
It does. And I think one of the big things is, if you look at history, we've backed away from where we were, say, during the Obama years, but not all that far, really. And yes, things are getting a little bit worse, but nothing like they were in, say, the 60s or 70s or 80s even. And so, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, we're dropping back, but I think we'll actually move further ahead after we get sort of through this little bit. And I really believe that.
Well, you know, we were ghettoized, very much ghettoized into our communities like Montrose and maybe the Heights. But now, especially with marriage equality, in fact, that GLBT people are adopting or having their own kids. They're involved in the PTOs. They're involved in the civic clubs. They're involved in all forms of participation within the community. And so their neighbors know them. The neighbors know what kind of people they are and what they do and how they support families. And so we are moving forward.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting because when I first moved to Houston, which, you know, was late 70s, somewhere around there, it was a little bit hard for someone who was out gay to buy a house just anywhere.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, had some friends that had a couple houses they were renting, and they were going to do a lease buy type thing with some people. And they're like, but our concern is they're gay couples, and we're worried about how they'll keep the house. And I'm like, oh, you're going to love this. Just trust me. Yeah. And like, they're both gay professionals. I'm like, no, you will have no problem. And they call me back about 6 months later, and they're like, these people are wonderful. We go to dinner with them. And I'm like, that's the way you actually fix any concerns.
Yeah, yeah. So, JD, your website, which, you know, you've done such incredible work on categorizing and putting out in the public on the website of the history. And are you going to continue that?
Oh, yes. Try and stop me. You know. It's HoustonLGBTHistory.org.
And
I add to it all the time.
So basically, it's like a full-time job for you now.
Yeah, I work on it every day. Just today, I added a new page for the bar Bacchus, which was a women's bar in the 80s, up until the 90s.
Right.
But, you know, who remembers it? Well, I do.
Right.
And I never set foot in the bar.
And Alexis, what are you involved in?
TFA was Transgender Foundation of America, and we have a lot of stuff we do. We have Transgender Archives. The other thing that we have is the Trans Advocate, which we've now had three stories picked up by the New York Times out of that we authored, which is sort of neat because the New York Times says really nice things, then you hear from lots of other people. And we have two international divisions right now in the UK and in Brazil. And we'll be opening something up in Japan, I'm told, soon. I have no idea. I can't read what they send us.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, you know, and there used to be criticism of even papers like the New York Times is that they never covered GLBT issues outside the country. Well, it's gotten much better.
Yes.
They're not always great stories. They're not always positive stories because of what's going on, but they are being covered. NPR, you know, they have done so much. You know, they didn't always do it in the early days. In fact, the Santa Diaries was very controversial when they, who's the author of Santa Diaries? The book writer. I mean, when they first put that on, an elf, a gay elf at Macy's around Christmas time. But we moved on.
Sedaris.
Yes, David Sedaris. They moved on. And in fact, I mean, recently, David Brancaccio on Marketplace, which is part of Morning Edition, mentioned that it was, you know, sexual preference. And I corrected him on that. I used to actually work with him at Metro Traffic. And yeah, I mean, you know, not every, we all make mistakes in using words, but, we're moving forward.
And the appropriate words change over time.
Yes.
Oh, I mean, can't keep up.
You know, and I know a lot of people think, oh, this is the term and word. No, no, it will change over time. And I think that that's the big problem, because frequently I find that I'm behind.
Well, and that's important. I mean, it's important that we look back at our history. Mm-hmm. It's important that we learn from our history. And it's important that we move on. And
back in the parade in 98, the banner said transgendered on it.
Yeah, and people wouldn't like that now.
No, no.
Yet at that time, that was a...
That was bold.
Yes.
Bold
yes.
Now.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, you know, my thing is that if it's not worse than I've been called before, then I'm okay with it. And that's not even close to as bad. But yeah. And some people get really, really, really overly concerned about that. And I think we need to think about it a little bit and say, look back at the history. As I said, I was gay for quite a few years, and then I didn't change, but I suddenly was not gay anymore because I was bi. And I'm like, why does that not make me gay?
Well, and so we look at this, and if you're listening tonight, which and you could be listening tomorrow, actually, because we're on Apple's podcast, that we have to move forward. And the only way we move forward is the people getting involved. And if you start going to an organization and don't like what they're doing, start a new one. Those people that go and celebrate Pride, which is going to be happening later this month, and have a wonderful time, just think about how all this happened. I mean, I heard stories before I was involved in Pride about how difficult it was to get a permit, how difficult it was to deal with the police department to be able to do that. And at one time, they wanted to have that parade early on a Sunday afternoon because we wouldn't be so drunk. You know, I mean, all of those things that happened and dealing with the police. And now we have one of the largest Pride celebrations, a night parade on a Saturday night. Which
and Pride itself has evolved so much just in the last 3 years.
Yes, it has. Right. And, you know, Pride was sort of the day that, you know, the streets, we own the streets. But we're learning now that, you know, the streets are ours all the time. And we should be able to take advantage of that and work through the system. And there's all types of things that you can do, from going to city council to talk at public session to going to commissioner's court in the county of Harris County, or just being part of a civic club or being part of a neighborhood group, watch group. All of those things are just really, really important. And so
the other thing you can do is when you see something that's not right, speak out.
Yes.
And just challenge people. I mean, it can be one-on-one, and maybe no one will know you did it, but it makes a huge difference.
Yes. And sometimes it's not screaming, it's talking. And I've learned that. I've learned that. You know, sometimes a bureaucrat working for the city is sometimes talking to people. And sometimes people just don't realize it, that what they're doing is, you know, offensive. Not always, but sometimes they do. And sometimes you win over people. Certainly, you know, I mean, like I said at the beginning of this program, is that being on a radio station like this, it was incredible. You know, as much as people complain about the Pride being corporate, the fact that we have some of these major sponsors helping pay for it is a major step, especially in Houston.
Forget about paying for it from my point of view. The fact they'll stand up and be right there and say, look, I'm supporting this organization, I'm supporting the LGBT community, that is unheard of. I mean, I was amazed when politicians first started showing up at Pride.
And boy, we had to work on that for years.
Yeah, and once they started showing up, everybody's like, oh my gosh, you've got to be there because it's hundreds of thousands of people.
My one of my stories I remember, Lee Brown was the first actual mayor that was in the parade. And, you know, we naturally put him up front. And when he got finished in the parade route, he had the car turned around and he sat and watched the rest of the parade. And, you know, that was amazing. I also heard a story that Chase Bank, who was part of the Pride Parade for many years, originally was not even a New York parade, but they were in the Houston Parade, and they filmed it. Mattress Max actually sponsored the parade, the disco ball, for a couple
of
years.
Right, chandelier.
The chandelier, yes, and in the corner of Montrose and Westheimer, 8.5 foot. The fact that TV stations covered it and gave us positive. None of that happened overnight. Those were long term working with them, explaining to them. You know, an organization called GLAAD helped try to educate the media on how to cover GLBT issues. I don't even know if GLAAD's still around.
But, they are.
That they did that. The fact that we're on popular network television and all of that.
Well, and, you know, with the parade, the beer companies figured out we drink beer.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was T-shirts and beer that paid for the early days of Pride. Well, I certainly want to thank you all for this enjoyable conversation.
Well, thank you.
We're going to continue this throughout June. And I also want to thank you for your contributions to this community, helping make this a better community and documenting this community. We're talking to Alexis Melvin and J.D. Doyle, and I'm Jack Volinsky, and we really appreciate being able to come to you every Monday night here on KPFT in Queer Voices.